This podcast exists because of the paid members at DecodingTV.com. Decoding TV is a podcast network that's currently also covering shows like Andor, She-Hulk, and The Rings of Power. Sign up to be a paid member and get ad-free episodes, early access to episodes, and exclusive bonuses that we'll record just for you. Thanks to everyone at DecodingTV.com who makes this podcast possible.
Aemond, look at me. Your king demands an answer. Who spoke these lies to you?
It was Uncle.
By the way, that was also Kim Renfro's reaction when I asked her if she wanted to do A Cast of Kings with me. Me? Me?
Me? A little drunk in the corner.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to A Cast of Kings, an unofficial recap podcast about the HBO original series House of the Dragon. I'm David Chen, and I have not read Fire and Blood, the book on which House of the Dragon is based.
And I'm Kim Renfro, and I have read Fire and Blood, the book upon which House of the Dragon is based.
Every week on this podcast, we recap, spoil, and discuss this episode of House of the Dragon that just aired. This week, we'll be recapping and spoiling Season 1, Episode 7, Driftmark. We will not spoil anything from future week's episodes. That includes anything on the next time on preview or anything from the books. You can find more of our episodes at acastofkings.com. Find us on YouTube at youtube.com/acastofkings and also on TikTok at tiktok.com/@acastofkings. You can always email us at acastofkings@gmail.com or find us on Twitter as well, at acastofkings. So before we get into Season 1, Episode 7, Driftmark, I want to acknowledge the feedback that we received from last week's episode. I want to talk just very briefly about it, which is, and I want to start by saying that I've been hosting this podcast for about 10 years. Which is a really long time to be a part of a show like this, and I've been grateful for to be a part of, tangentially a part of the Game of Thrones community, as I describe it, right? This podcast has been, and always will be, from the perspective of a show watcher who is being guided through the show by a book reader. That is what the original pitch for the show was. That is what we have tried to live out in our ideals and in the execution of the show. And I'm really proud of the fact that we are a podcast that does this. Last week on the podcast, I expressed some difficulty with the time jumps, and I thought they were inhibiting a storytelling, a view that was very widely expressed by a lot of show watchers, a lot of people writing about the show across various parts of the internet. And I was very dismayed at some of the feedback that I got, which was not respectful disagreement or, hey, I'm not sure I agree with you, Dave, or here's why the time jumps are good, actually, but was very much like, you shouldn't be allowed to even express your opinion, David Chen, or your opinion is invalid. Like, how dare you question them? Or basically, questioning any competence I had to even discuss a show in this way. And that's very disappointing. So I think I just wanted to say that I think that we have tried to create a podcast that is welcoming to show watchers only, that is welcoming to book readers as well, and that sometimes it will result in show watchers only being confused about what's happening on screen. And I feel it's my job to express that confusion when it happens. You don't have to agree, but like, that is the premise of the podcast. There are many podcasts out there, hundreds even, that will not talk about the show like this,
mm-hmm.
You know, that will not evaluate the show in the way that we're evaluating it. If you have an issue with how we're doing this task, you should check out those other podcasts. I hope in addition to this one, you know, but there are other podcasts that will do it in the way that I think a lot of people are looking for, which will not be critical of things like the time jumps. And for me, as a consumer myself, I want the kind of varied perspective something.
Mm-hmm.
Like that's what I am looking for in my media. And And so that's what we're going to try to bring to you here on Acast Kings. So just wanted to briefly mention it. Kim, I don't know if you had any thoughts on it as well, but.
Yeah, I mean, I personally find it wild that anybody would take time out of their day to be mean about somebody else's like perspective and opinion on anything. I find it incredibly helpful to hear from you about like where things might be losing you or how certain structures might not be working, because it is reflective of the way that a big subset of fans are watching this show. I mean, I was just watching the episode. Finally, my husband caught up with it over the weekend. And we're sitting on the couch watching episode 6, and I paused it multiple times to explain to him, like, okay, that's who those kids are. And he was like, what is happening? He was like almost in the exact same boat, it seemed like, that you were. And he lives with a Game of Thrones expert in his house. I think it's incredibly valuable to be able to talk through different perspectives, throw out maybe like different analyses of why things are shaking out the way that they are. And it's perfectly fine for people to not agree. Like, we're not here to have perfectly in sync opinions about the show. We're here to each bring our unique perspective to how something as massive as the first prequel series to Game of Thrones is shaking out in the week to week experience. So it's great to be able to do that with you. And I have no qualms with us disagreeing from time to time in a respectful manner.
I agree. And I just want to point out, like, Kim has been an incredible partner to go on this journey with through House of the Dragon, and has been extremely supportive of me sharing my thoughts on this podcast and in private when we talk about, you know, prepping for the podcast and so on. So I am really grateful to Kim for just her openness. And I do want to reemphasize what she said, which is like, you don't have to agree with everything we say. Like, I'm not saying, well, if you like the time jumps, you're dumb. Like, that's not what I'm saying. I'm just asking you to not have the opposite, the inverse opinion, you know, right. Which is like, if I don't like that I'm dumb, you know? I do also want to point this out, which is that I think that there are issues with last episode that go beyond the time jumps. I am going to, I host another podcast called The Filmcast. And we have a kind of bonus episode segment we called the Filmcast After Dark. On last week's Filmcast After Dark, I talked with my colleague Jeff about House of the Dragon. Jeff is a show watcher only, mm-hmm. So he has not read the books. He loves the time jumps. He thinks they're incredible. He thinks that they give a scope of history that is impossible with a typical show like Game of Thrones, right? So he has no issue with the time jumps. He was completely baffled by how last episode handled some of the casting changes. And I'm going to play a clip for you from that episode. I put harp noises at the beginning and end of this clip so you can understand where the clip begins and ends. But here's a clip from the Filmcast After Dark with Jeff Cannata talking about season 1, episode 6 of House of the Dragon.
It's such a different vibe. Like, yes. I don't feel like I know these people. It feels like I'm in the Uncanny Valley. It's weird. Yeah. It's like, that's not that character. It's very odd to me.
And I think because they have different personalities, too. Like, a lot has changed in 10 years. So,
which you would expect. I mean, that makes sense sort of contextually, it's super jarring. And I mean, they didn't even do the like slow dissolve, you know?
Oh yeah. It's bizarre the way they did it.
But they could have had like at least seed some flash forward or flashback earlier in the show.
Something or like have, here's the thing, have someone say their name, like introduce them, you know, like
we watched an entire birth at the beginning of that episode.
You don't know who it is.
No idea who it is. I'm like, these are all new characters.
You don't know who it is unless you've read the press reports of who's playing who, right? But many people might not have, right?
We didn't. My wife and I didn't. And we're like, and then they're walking in and I'm like, he calls her,
Rhaenyra.
And I'm like, no, that's not, I turn to my wife. And then her husband comes in. I'm like, I could kind of see that being the older version of that guy, but this is crazy. This is weird. Mm-hmm. And it's just so strange. And the vibe of them and I have no idea who all these children are and whose children are what. And like the show does nothing to help you. It does nothing.
So that was my friend Jeff Cannata expressing his confusion with last episode. If anything, Kim, I did not go far enough. with my critiques. I mean, again,
that's passionate feelings everyone's having.
That is from someone who loves the time jumps. Mm-hmm. They're like, the time jumps are incredible. And there's still qualms about how the show has handled and possibly will handle casting transitions in the future, right? Yeah, go ahead.
It's so interesting to me because I think it's emblematic of a much larger thing happening right now with the relationship between entertainment coverage content and TV shows and movies and adaptations and things, because I think that this is a good example of, like, I'm sure that the folks involved with the casting decisions and the script writing and everything knew that there were people like me in the world. There's many of us who, like, my job is often to translate things that might need a little bit more explaining from the screen to, like, an average TV watcher. And so to me, it's so interesting because it did not occur to me that somebody would be unaware of the fact that all of those actors, that there had been four actors cast to play Rainier and Allison, young and old, like, from the get-go. In our press screeners, like, we had a specific note saying, like, hey, please make sure to watch episode 6 because that's when the cast changes and we would like that for that to be, like, included in your reviews. So, like, I had every forewarning going into it that this was happening. And it's true that some people don't watch TV like that. Some people aren't reading the Entertainment Weekly covers of a new series coming up. Some people aren't reading, you know, every single piece of extraneous information about a show before it premieres. And so I think it's valuable to hear that feedback from people who are like, I was genuinely lost as to, like, what is happening in the show right now. Whereas a lot of people like me completely knew that it was coming, didn't skip a beat. I was just straight into being really interested to see how Emma Darcy played Rhaenyra, you know? So people are coming at the show from varying levels of engagement with, like, all of the extraneous stuff that goes into it. And that's perfectly valid.
Yeah. I mean, I think that here's a fair point that I will concede is that if you're listening to this podcast, you're probably familiar with the cast change, right? Like,
yeah,
that is a huge possibility. And I mean, I got a lot of people writing in being like, come on, David, you didn't know about the cast change. It's like, yes, thank you. Yes. I've spoken with Kim Renfro every week for the last 10 weeks. I am aware that the cast change occurred.
Yeah.
But I also feel that it is part of my job on this podcast to evaluate it from the perspective of somebody who is just watching the show and has no other information about the show.
Yeah. Because some people are like that. They don't want to see the previews for next week's episode because they want the experience to be entirely, like, fresh and exciting to them. And it's true that they are asking a lot of you by dropping you in to this episode with, and, like, having to figure out exactly how much time has passed. You might think that that's, even if you got that was Rhaenyra right away, you might have assumed that that's her first child. And then boom, she has two already very grown children. Like, yeah. it's a lot of information that you're being asked to process in a single go.
Yeah, indeed. Well, anyway, I wanted to acknowledge some of the feedback that came in, but also acknowledge that, like, on some level, I feel I went really far in criticizing the time jumps last week. And to some degree, I felt like I didn't criticize the episode enough for some of the decisions that it made that aren't even related to the time jumps. We didn't even talk about kind of how that transition occurred that much, you know? So anyway, wanted to acknowledge that. Of course, you can always email us at acastofkings@gmail.com. And especially if you enjoy what we're doing, would really be great to hear some of that. Great to hear some of that feedback as well. That'd be greatly appreciated. Okay. The only other thing I wanted to mention before we get into this week's episode, Kim, is there was some debate last week about why Larys had people's tongues cut off if he was then also going to give them his sigil. Larys has a sigil on his cane, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What is that sigil?
It's apparently a firefly is what he's taken up as his, like, personal little sneaky symbol.
I like how Pernicious Ducks put it at decodingtv.com. Sapochnik flare strikes again. Daemon flying through dragonfire despite not being fireproof. Cutting out guys' tongues only to give them symbols of who he works for. It doesn't really make sense, but gotta get that cool stuff on screen, end quote. The Daemon stuff felt like, you know, a fine little fun stylistic flourish, but it did feel really weird to me that you'd have an incredibly graphic scene of a guy's tongue getting cut out and then have Larys give them a firefly sigil on top of it, which is a sigil that he has on his cane and could easily be traced back to him. weird decision. And the Sapochnik flare that Pernicious Ducks is referring to is basically showing incredibly graphic, violent stuff on screen that doesn't really make much sense in the context of the story. I did think it was just weird. It's weird that he's, and typically when you show something that violent on screen, like a tongue getting cut off, there's like a really good story reason for it. And maybe there wasn't in this case, but if you understood one, let us know at acastofkings@gmail.com.
It wasn't until just now when you were talking about that, I was like, I guess in this most recent episode, Viserys like looks very pointedly at Alicent and says that if anybody else dares to question the parentage of Rhaenyra's children, that they'll have their tongue cut out. And I was like, oh, well, now I know exactly what that looks like and what he's threatening to have done to Alicent.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah. So in other words, it did have a storytelling
maybe
purpose,
maybe they were setting us up to be like, oh, that's a pretty gnarly threat that he, I don't know. I'm being generous here. I didn't think much of it because the whole tongue getting cut off thing is prevalent in Westeros. And I was like, yeah, of course they're doing this again to the people in the black cells.
That is old hat now. It's
yeah.
Old hat.
Yeah.
The tongue getting cut off.
Yeah.
Him is a hardened viewer at this point. So. All right, everyone. You are watching or listening to A Cast of Kings at acastofkings.com. We are talking about season one, episode 7 of House of the Dragon, Driftmark. As usual, Kim Renfro, let's start with overall thoughts on this episode. What'd you think?
I'm continuing my trend of just loving it. I again was curious to see like what they were going to do with the time jump in this episode or how much time would pass. And I like that this is like pretty much one 24-hour period, it seems like, that a lot happens in. And so it was kind of cool to see that like awkward family funeral dynamic play out in this Westerosi culture. So much cool stuff with dragons happening in this episode, a ramping up of violence, Daemon and Rhaenyra. I've been waiting for this episode ever since I think it was our very first episode of A Cast of Kings this season where you were like, yeah, yeah. So it's like they're clearly setting up that like Daemon and Rhaenyra
are the opposing teams,
opposing teams. And I was like, uh-huh, yeah, very, very interesting. I wonder.
Kim has the best poker face. it's actually incredible, honestly. I'm actually
Thanks.
Quite impressed with how good the poker face is, because there's been so many times when she's, you know, I've said something that basically is extremely silly in the broader context of what ends up happening. And Kim has said nothing. And that is what I have asked her to do. And she's done a great job of that. So in terms of not spoiling stuff, I should point out, I obviously want Kim's insights and opinions on things. So anyway,
what do you think? What are your overalls?
My overall thought.
What are your overalls, David Chen?
Yes. My overall thoughts are I quite like this episode. This episode takes place seemingly within a week after last, or within 2 weeks after last episode, right? There's a funeral that goes on for Elena who died last episode. So very short amount of time has passed. And as you pointed out, it is really cool that this episode takes place basically within a 24-hour period. That was fairly rare for like Game of Thrones to have an episode that took place in a 24-hour period, you know, so you really can kind of get to see some of these character dynamics, interpersonal dynamics play out in a cool way. I really loved the scene in the Driftmark lobby, antechamber, whatever, the hall, you know, the great hall, wherever it is, where like all the characters gather. It's rare to see all the characters like gather like that. I mean, we did see it in the wedding scene a couple weeks ago where there's a ton of characters in one location, but then everything just felt so unpredictable and tense there. It felt like anything could escalate, anything could happen.
Yeah.
And that's just really well done in terms of storytelling, filmmaking, in my opinion. I really enjoyed the ending. I know the ending was a great shock to many book readers, but for me as a show watcher, it just played like a really well-executed montage. And I really liked, you know, what it was doing and what it was saying about Rhaenyra. I do still have some qualms, still have some kind of remnant issues from last week that I will try to limit in terms of my conversation with this episode. But overall, I really was a fan of this episode and certainly enjoyed it much more than last week's episode. So anyway, let's get into it.
Let's do it.
The episode begins with a funeral at Driftmark. It's Lena that is being put to rest. And this scene was really cool. Mm-hmm. I just have to say, like, the way they, the production design, the way they kind of show you the rituals that mm-hmm. occur at Driftmark, you get the sense that this is not the first time something of this has been done. Lena's sea casket, which looks like it's made of stone, and just kind of the speech that is being given, the eulogy, whatever it's called, you know, it's all just, it all plays off as like a really honorable way to kind of put this person to rest, and visually very interesting. What do you think of the funeral at Driftmark?
Yeah, as sad as I was to see that Lena pretty much came and went in a single episode, at least the adult version of Lena, I appreciated that this episode gives so much breathing space to the fact that that death was really tragic. You see, exactly as you said, sort of like the ceremony, all of the High Valyrian speech. We get a reference to the Merling King, who in Fire and Blood, they say that the Driftwood throne, which is that throne made out of driftwood, is in Lord Corlys's chamber. Like, that throne, according to legend, was gifted to the Valyrians by the Merling King. So we get like cool little sprinkles of religious references. It's also funny because I looked it up. The Merlin King is the name of the ship that in Game of Thrones Littlefinger used to smuggle Sansa out of King's Landing after Joffrey's death. So just fun little, those little, I love when like my little sensors go off with like, mm-hmm. wait a second, that was a thing to this other thing. So fun little details built in there. I love that, of course, Daemon is the one who laughs at a funeral. Like, mm-hmm. classic.
But also, he's like the only one for which it would be even remotely socially acceptable to laugh at that funeral, I think.
Yeah.
But anyway, Otto is there. He's Hand of the King. And you know he's Hand because he looks down at his little hand pin and kind of like gives it a little tap, you know, to reaffirm that it's still there.
Yeah. He's feeling himself at this funeral.
So it does feel like Larys's gambit has paid off, right? Like, We can fill in the blanks that Viserys called Otto in the interim and brought him back. So mm-hmm.
interesting that Viserys has failed to acquire a single other trusted ally in the last 10 years mm-hmm. who he might possibly put back into this position.
Yes, yes. I mean, I think we could use the phrase, it's interesting that nothing has happened around blank topic in the last 10 years for a lot of different things, but we're not going to. Okay. We see the dragons flying over the castle high tide. And we see for the first time, I think, 5 dragons on screen at once.
Yeah.
And it makes sense. It makes sense. It's like, oh yeah, of course all the dragons would be there. Cause everyone would kind of, some people would fly to be there. They're not going to leave the dragons at home. They're not going to leave the Porsche at home. They're going to take that thing to the place that they're going to, of course.
Yeah. The nuclear bomb Porsche is coming with them to the
part. It's part Porsche, part nuclear bomb. They're not going to leave that at home. Of course they're going to bring it with them.
Yeah. Yeah. We saw 5, and then you can assume that Vhagar is off screen at some point. So this is like 6 dragons that have all gathered for this funeral. And in the book, there's a sort of mention that like Driftmark almost felt like the old Valyrian times once again, because this was like this was the highest number of dragons that had been like collected around a single space in a very long time. So yeah, I'm pretty sure there's 5 total dragons. So it's like, you assume that probably Daemon brought Caraxes, Rhaenyra on Syrax, Laenor's dragon is Sea Smoke, Rhaenys, who's Laenor and Lena's mother, the queen who never was, her dragon is Maelys. And then I think that the 5th dragon is probably supposed to be either Aegon or Baela or Helaena's dragons, but I'm not sure because we haven't seen those ones up close yet in the show, but hopefully we will soon.
So then there is this wake, right, at this castle. Mm-hmm. And all the family is meeting together. And I believe this was like the first scene that was ever filmed with all these actors.
Yeah. You know,
according to the after the episodes information. And I do think it did feel a little bit awkward to me. But I was cool with it because I felt like this is the kind of awkwardness that ensues whenever you bring family members together. in a big way that they're not usually used to being together. Of course, there's all these like pre-existing relationships and thoughts and feelings, and they're all going to collide in this weird and awkward way. And so I felt like any awkwardness was completely intentional on the part of the show.
Yeah.
A bunch of different interactions going on here. I don't know which ones you feel are worth highlighting, Kim, but we did get one of the things I did enjoy was like Rhaenyra walking in and then Allison kind of just giving her the stink eye. Like that was funny because obviously they're still not on good terms. Helena, who is Allison's daughter.
Yes.
Is playing with a spider, right? Is that right?
Yeah, so she is once again kind of speaking in this like cryptic rhyme. And yeah, I had to poker face myself last week because in episode 6, basically the same thing happened where like we see Helena and she's just sort of like talking to herself. She said she referenced the fact that Aemond was going to lose an eye when Aemond and Allison are talking about the fact that he doesn't have a dragon yet. Helena said he'll have to close an eye. And it was like, okay, what the hell does that mean? And then in this episode, you see that the trade-off for him claiming Vhagar was the fact that he loses an eye. So yeah, she's saying something else in this episode where now I'm like, okay, what prophecy or like dragon dream is that referencing? She says, quote, hand turns loom, spool of green, spool of black, dragons of flesh weaving dragons of thread, end quote. So decipher that as you will.
I mean, as a book reader, have you deciphered it already? Like, do you know what it is?
No, but I haven't tried very hard because I didn't want to get ahead of myself here. Just laying that out.
Either way, it seems like Helena can like somehow tell the future, right?
Yes, we're getting told that she is effectively a dragon dreamer, which is what King Viserys is, where they have these sort of like prophetic dreams. And she's being treated by her brothers like she's a weirdo because of it, instead of like, oh, that's a pretty sweet asset to have in the family. But
I don't think they fully put together that, you know, they...
that she's actually predicting the future.
That she's predicting the future yet, you know, but...
True.
All they see is a budding entomologist, and they are... they're disappointed by that for some reason. But yeah, so Aegon, who is the older one...
Yes.
The older son of Alicent, blonde...
Yeah. Yeah.
Talking to Aemond, the younger son of Alicent, also blonde.
Yes.
They kind of joke about marrying their sister, and Aemond is like, I would do it to secure, to make the Valyrian bloodline pure. Aegon, meanwhile, is getting completely lit at this funeral, basically. So.
Yeah. Oh. Zelda again.
For those who are watching the YouTube version, a little cameo from Kim's cat. On the video stream. Kim, any other interactions in the funeral wake that you want to mention?
I thought it was sweet to see Rhaenyra like encourage her boy, Jace, the oldest, to go comfort Daemon's daughters, Baela and Rhaena. Presumably they haven't met until this family gathering because we're supposed to believe that Daemon and Rhaenyra haven't seen each other in 10 years since that welcome wedding feast in episode 5. But they seem to have like bonded pretty quickly to each other. And they sort of like, I kind of remember that from my days of like the family functions, like you sort of meet your cousins and become BFFs with them within like 24 hours if you're the only kids hanging around. So that was a sweet little moment. Also, like young Luke saying that he doesn't want to inherit Driftmark because if he does, that means everybody's dead. And I'm like, these kids are getting into it early of like of understanding like the danger and the sacrifice that is involved with having to be the ruling class of this country.
Luke is Rhaenyra's brown-haired son.
Yeah.
Right. And therefore technically Lord Corlys's grandson. And that's why he would be the inheritor of Driftmark.
Yes, because he's the second born child of the future queen, basically. So his inheritance is going to be Driftmark because that is Laenor's, that's supposed to be Laenor Valyrian's inheritance, his quote unquote father.
Yeah, and the idea is Rhaenyra's firstborn would be the king, the future king.
Yes. So Jace, Jacerys, who they call Jace, her oldest, her firstborn son, also brown-haired boy, little mop. He was so cute in this episode. Like that whole, like, you know, I'm hiding my eyes because I'm becoming an angsty teen haircut that he has going on. Very cute.
Also, you pointed out on Twitter, or you retweeted someone on Twitter saying like big Jon Snow energy with like, I don't want it, you know, which is what
Luke
says, right?
Yeah.
Luke, Rhaenyra's child, says, I don't want it, which is the same thing that Jon Snow said when he was deemed to be the inheritor. Mm-hmm. Here's something that confused me, Kim, was during the episode, Aegon and Aemond are talking, and then I think it was one of them says, that's your future queen over there, speaking about Helaena.
Oh, yeah, good catch.
So that was a little confusing because I'm like, wait, are they assuming that Aegon is eventually going to be king? And
that's what Alicent has been telling Aegon.
So that statement is made with the assumption that Alicent is right about Aegon eventually being the heir, right?
Yeah,
so.
No, totally. Not to mention, I think that it shows that they are treating incest as a very casual thing between them of like, I'm going to marry my sister and produce children with her, presumably. I think kind of shows a little bit of the hypocrisy of like, so Alicent thinks it's completely vile and gross that Rhaenyra and Daemon might have coupled or whatever. And yet, like, here she is as a grown woman, and she's fully fine with teaching her sons that it is their duty to marry, for one of them to marry their sister eventually and have heirs.
Hey, everyone. Going to cut in here to tell you about one of our sponsors, ExpressVPN. Now, as a co-host of a Cast of Kings podcast, I really got to bring my A game when it comes to the Game of Thrones knowledge, and I sometimes end up Googling a lot of stuff that happens in House of the Dragon just so I can show up well for my co-host. But I don't really want her finding out about it. And I know some of you are probably thinking, well, why don't you just use incognito mode? Let me tell you something. Incognito mode does not hide your activity. It doesn't matter what mode you use or how many times you clear your browsing history. Your internet service provider can still see every website you've ever visited. That's why even when I'm at home, I never go online without using ExpressVPN. Doesn't matter who your ISP is. ISPs can legally sell your information to ad companies. ExpressVPN is an app that reroutes your internet connection through their secure servers, so your ISP can't see the sites you visit. ExpressVPN also keeps all of your information secure by encrypting 100% of your data with the most powerful encryption available. Most of the time, I don't even realize I have ExpressVPN on. It runs seamlessly in the background. It's so easy to use, and it's available on all your devices, phones, computers, even your smart TV. Protect your online activity today with the VPN rated number one by Business Insider. Visit our exclusive link, expressvpn.com/castofkings, and you can get an extra 3 months free on a 1-year package. That's expressvpn.com/castofkings. expressvpn.com/castofkings to learn more. Thanks to ExpressVPN for sponsoring this episode. There is a scene where Laenor is standing at the high tide crying instead of being at the wake, and then Corlys says to Carl, retrieve your patron. He's very upset about it. What is going on here? Why is it, like, I guess Laenor is upset because his sister's dead.
Mm-hmm.
And they are believed to have a close relationship, right? And so that's very reasonable.
Yeah.
But yeah, what's any ideas of like what's going on with this sequence? Like,
I thought it was interesting that like so many other people seem to like clock this exchange and be talking about it. It like, I think, seems to be one more example of the way that gossip is probably spreading around the realm. Like Corlys so obviously referring to Carl's like patron, meaning that's a person who pays you to stick around, right? So I think it was like a slight dig at the idea that like Carl is no more than like a hired boyfriend for the king consort. And Laenor's like standing in the water, clearly like wasted. I think Corlys just wanted him to like, wanted Laenor to stop embarrassing himself in front of people. But the way that he went about it actually just brought more attention to the fact that Laenor and Carl were there. So I think that it's good stage setting for the fact that they both are going to want to escape by the end of the episode and rid themselves of like the sort of facade that they have going on of like, oh, you're simply my like, you know, good pal who just happens to come around with me everywhere.
There is a conversation between Viserys and Daemon as well. And I guess these brothers have been through a lot at this point. But what I do get a sense of is collegiality between these two at this point. There's no longer the kind of open warfare and enmity that obviously was in the earlier episodes of the show. Anything you want to highlight about that interaction?
I just think Viserys is a little flip-flopping man who can't figure out if he wants to like extend the olive branch or punish Daemon. And yeah, I guess Daemon makes it through this episode without being banished again. But like this, I almost thought it was funny that like Viserys is like, oh, we're like every other episode. Now I'm going to have a nice conversation with you. Now I'm going to get pissed again. Like Viserys, I think just can't. Viserys seems to have a really hard time sticking to a decision and like following through on that. And like, yes, you can assume that after 10 years, things might have softened between them. Viserys is clearly like doing way worse with his health. But yeah, I was just like, man, you really can't not give Daemon like third, fourth, fifth, sixth chances here to like be around and be a part of the family.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Certainly he's not going to do anything that's going to interfere with the line of succession in any way. Anyway. All right. Anything else about the funeral wake? We see Otto kicking the crap out of Aegon and
Messed you know. Up. I don't agree with Otto and Allison's.
Kim is not a believer in corporal punishment. I don't know if you guys can't tell.
Even in medieval times, man, you really gotta slap around like who you believe is gonna be the future king. Like you think that's the best way to handle this? Not mm-hmm. great. The only mm-hmm. other thing I don't think I noticed until I watched it a second time is that Viserys calls Alicent Emma on his yes. way out from the party. And I was like, ooh, like now he's having memory like ish. Like I like couldn't tell. I'm like, are they implying that he's starting to like literally untether from his current reality? Or like was it just a Freudian slip thing of like he's thinking about his first wife? But that was a pretty, like the way that Sir Harold, who's the current captain of the Kingsguard, gently correct, like tries to like correct him without correcting him by being like, should I see after Queen Alicent, your current wife? Should I see after her?
Yes, yes.
And then, yeah.
I do think it was, the next statement I'm about to say has nothing to do with time jumps. I do think it's a bit of a cheat what the show did in episode 5 and the transition to episode 6. Like Viserys collapsing at the end of episode 5. Like the show language, filmmaking language is the next episode, that guy is either dead or he's on a deathbed. So the idea that he is still alive and well, like it's no longer a thing I feel I can track. I guess you do see him losing body parts throughout the course of the season. So that is like a way you can kind of track his decline. But yeah, it was an interesting touch because he otherwise seems completely lucid in this episode, right?
Yeah. And I think, so this is something that I was also kind of wondering about, like why they show him sort of deteriorating so much in episode 5. I've traced it back to that conversation that Otto and Alicent have, right? Where before he leaves, when he gives her like one final lecture about like, if you don't understand now that you are in danger and that your children are in danger, like I give up basically, you know, he kind of like put this fear in her that not only her life, but that the life of her children are at risk the moment Viserys dies, because that's when the line of succession question is going to snap into effect, right? And he says something to her of like, it might be weeks or it might be months, but like the king is going to die. And then you see her see Viserys collapse multiple times. And so I think that that is supposed to be letting us know that she is like, she has put herself in a state of constant fear that Viserys might die any moment. And then we mm-hmm. jump ahead and it's like, okay, so for 10 years, you've been thinking like, this might be it. This might be the time that he goes. So it's like, she's been on edge, ready to try and defend her children from the sword, even though that's like a made up threat, right? Like Otto, like, I don't think that Rhaenyra at any point in the last 10 years has seriously thought to herself, well, the second my dad dies, I'm going to have to go murder those kids over there. But that's what Alicent thinks Rhaenyra might be thinking at every moment. So that's my only like That's the only reason why I think they might be kind of going a little hard on the fact that Viserys is deteriorating without doing what you said, which is like, if you're showing him collapsing, especially as like the cliffhanger to an episode, it tracks that he would be dead or dying in the next episode, but he's hanging on and Alicent is getting more and more unraveled by the day, I think, because of that.
Mm. I think that is a little bit of a reach, but I buy it. I buy it, and it's really good insight, Kim. So I'm being 100%. I'm not being sarcastic. I'm like, no. I don't know that a casual viewer might like put that all together, but I think you put it together very, very beautifully. So,
and I think that that is again part of the rub of like the way that they're trying to seed things in, because even I explained last week, in the background they show the Maester switch, and in the book it's explained that because a new maester has taken over, like Viserys is able to live longer effectively because this new maester has different treatments for whatever ailment he's giving. They did not try and explain that at all in the episode. They just hoped that you would pick up on the fact that it's a different maester there, and that that's the maester who a few episodes ago like suggested a new poultice for his grace. So you're right that it is right. Like you have to like be doing
you have to really like put the pieces together. Yeah. And you know, and it's not necessarily bad for a show to ask that of the audience, right? Like, there are some shows like, here's another show, Dark, the Netflix original series. You really got to work to watch Dark, in my opinion.
You got to have
like a freaking worksheet with all the character faces and everything on it to really understand that show.
But that doesn't make it a bad show,
you know, just because you got to do some work for it. So
yeah, I'll send you my like 100-page Google Doc of notes for Dark. That was the most challenging show to try and unwind. Yeah. So yeah, it happens.
Conversation between Corlys and Rhaenys. Rhaenys is not happy that Daemon rebuffed Laena's desire to return to Westeros.
Mm-hmm.
Implies that they had better maesters here, you know, that would have been able to help Laena with her birth. There was something you wanted to point it out here that was different from the book, right, Kim?
Yeah, well, Laena's death in general was different, played out differently in the show than it happens in the books. In the book, she actually does make it back to Westeros, and her and Rhaenyra, like, are said to have been really close. And that there's like an explanation that they basically like try and have different maesters help her through the childbirth, mm-hmm. but that ultimately fails. And she winds up in the book, they say that she died like on the stairs basically while trying to get to Vhagar, not so that she could be self-immolated, but, or like, you know, via her dragon immolated, but because she wanted to ride her one last time before she died. Mm,
interesting.
Yeah.
Immolated, by the way.
Immolated. What did I even say?
You were saying immolulated or something like
that? You know. Yeah. Thanks. Thank you for saving me from myself.
Yeah, no problem, Kim. So they have a conversation that's very similar to the one that you watch Breaking Bad?
Like, yeah.
What is that? It's a yes or no question, Kim.
I watched most of it. I think that there's some season in the middle where I didn't see all those episodes, and then I came back in for that.
Spoilers. Can I spoil the ending of Breaking
Bad?
I'm going to spoil the ending of Breaking Bad, but there's a scene at the whole time Walter White is saying that he's doing all these horrible things for his family, quote unquote.
Right.
And then at the very end of the show, his wife is like, please stop saying you're doing this for your family. And then he finally, in the final episode, I think, of the show, he's like, I did it for me. And that's basically the conversation that Corlys and Rhaenys have in this scene where he's like, I just want what's best for my children. And she's like, please stop saying you want what's best for your family. Like, you want what's best for you.
Hmm.
And they have a frank conversation about the fact that his grandchildren are not actually his legitimate grandchildren. They actually are not connected by blood to him at all. Which leads him to make the statement, history does not remember blood, it remembers names, end quote. And he kind of like breaks away from Rhaenys. And I think the point that he's making is it doesn't matter if they are not related to me by blood. It just matters that we all have the same name and that history remembers our name. And you wrote in the show notes, that's pretty progressive. Hey, good job, Corlys.
Yeah. I think that he has a point, and I think that it also helps highlight the fact that it's really Alicent and Kristen who seem intent on like keeping the conversation going about the fact that Rhaenyra's children are bastards. I feel like every single other person in that cast, in the Red Keep, would probably be happy to like feign ignorance for the rest of their lives.
They're all invested in this fiction, basically, right? Like,
yeah.
It is to their advantage to believe the fiction, right?
Yeah, and so. I can see why, especially last episode, that seemed like a big mistake on Rhaenyra's on Rhaenyra's behalf, right? That like her choice to have these children, to have more than one child out of wedlock, has put her and her children in danger, and like the whole line of succession in danger. But then, as we see in this episode, like, her and Laenor did try, apparently, to have children of their own. And once you have that piece of information, then I think Corlys's point kind of is even better, because it's like they're the ones that got Laenor in that situation, knowing, like, Rhaenys knew for sure, based on a conversation that we saw them have, that Laenor was not sexually interested in women. And like, what do you think's gonna happen when you put a gay man as future king consort? Like, I think that there was always this risk that he might not produce children of his own blood with Rhaenyra. And Corlys seemed to have like accepted that and immediately moved on to like, well, fine, we're going to treat these boys as our own. Whereas Rhaenys is now having an issue with it. And it's like, I feel like Laenor and Rhaenyra were in a little bit of a lose-lose situation there, because they needed to have heirs. Like, that's the whole question of the line of succession, is about having multiple generations being prepared at the same time for the line of succession, right? They couldn't go 10 years without having a kid. That would have once again put her claim at risk. So, yeah.
There is a scene on the beach between Daemon and Rhaenyra where they basically catch up on the last 10 years. Now, and kind of reveal a lot of the information that you just covered about trying to have a kid. There was no joy in it. And Rhaenyra did get a lot of comfort from Ser Harwyn. We get a little bit more of that relationship and what that must have been like. If I am to try to argue in favor of the time jumps, I think this is kind of one area where I kind of try to explore it in my head a little bit, because, on last week's episode, I put forward the possibility, oh, they should have just done a whole season with these actors and and they could have referred to stuff that happened in the past via monologues or dialogue or whatever. And here's a scene where I feel like, oh, that probably wouldn't have worked out very well. Like, if the story is that Daemon and Rhaenyra haven't met in 10 years, then seeing that past interaction play out on screen is really critical to understanding what their relationship might be like at present state. However, you know, like, they didn't have to tell the story in that way. Like, they could have told it in such a different way where, I don't know, they're writing letters to each other or some other way of them knowing each other in the last 10 years that gives you some more context for that relationship.
Yeah.
So I don't know, but I guess, like, as I was watching the scene, I was like, this is one of the strongest kind of scenes in favor of a time jump and or different actors playing it, is like, without the context of the Daemon Rhaenyra story in the past, this romance obviously happens like extremely suddenly, and it's asking you to buy a lot. You know, it's asking you to buy that, like, she'd be attracted to her uncle and that they would rekindle this long lost love that they had for each other. And that just doesn't work.
Yeah.
In my opinion, unless you have either more time with these two characters and their relationship in present day or in the past. All that said, it does still happen quite suddenly in this episode. What do you think of how it played out, Kim?
Yeah, I think it's so... I think it was very interesting that she just straight up like called him out on abandoning her as a child, like, not only after that first sexual encounter that they had, but then after, like, presumably... in the middle of that, like, they were about to make out on the dance floor, when the chaos broke out at the wedding feast, you know, and then presumably Damon just vanished.
Yeah, he just peaced out and never came back ever again, I guess.
Never came back, didn't presumably check up on her, see how she was doing, just like assumed that she would be fine. And I mean, she mostly was. It seems like she had a decent life in the last 10 years. But I think that this episode is when you see exactly where all of the lines are being drawn between people. And it's very obvious why she views Damon as not only like a personal comfort to her, but as a very, very powerful, strong ally in what she now understands is going to be like a bloody, and like, this is when first blood is drawn, right? In this episode, literally, mm-hmm. between the two families. And I think that exactly to your point, like the last six episodes have shown us very clearly how effective Damon is at violence and like, mm-hmm. And commanding that level of like power that not very many people have in the realm, of like the way that Targaryens are sort of viewed as almost godlike, above the law type of people. Like Damon and Rhaenyra are creating their own little like modern family of, I don't know, aggressive and progressive Targaryens.
Yeah. I am curious to see how the Damon personality is going to play out, you know? Because I think he's, in my opinion, extremely different than when we last saw him, right? He was full of fire and piss and vinegar, you know, in the first five episodes of the show. And now he's calmed down extremely. We described it last episode as he had a tough 20s and he's now in his calmer, more subdued 30s. Mm-hmm. You describe him in the show notes this week as he's in his post-grad era. He like has already found himself, like he knows what he's all about.
Uh-huh.
And so I do hope that, I think to its credit, the show has done a good job of showing us a different Damon than what we had in the first five episodes. Like, mm-hmm. this is a very different character. And I hope that as the episodes evolve, that the character doesn't just go back to his old ways, that we see some conflict between what we are seeing now and then what we have seen in the first five episodes, right?
Yeah.
To me, that will be the mark of like successfully pulling off this character transition, mm-hmm. From old Damon to new Damon. So. All right, we're going to take a quick break for a word from our sponsors. We'll be back soon with more discussion of Season 1, Episode 7 of House of the Dragon. Okay, they have sex on the beach in a conveniently placed tent.
I know.
That happens to be there.
That little wooden structure.
Super convenient. Seems to have like some like flaps and coverings and stuff like that already. It's amazing. It's amazing. maybe not the first time that it's been used for this purpose, but... Anyway, they have sex, and I don't know if there's anything else we have to say about that topic.
Aside from the fact that they've shown us Rhaenyra's two seemingly like tender and sweet sex scenes with Christian and Cole, and now Damon is so, and we've seen both of her weddings, and we have seen none of those scenes for Alicent. Right. So mm-hmm. I the only thing that was striking to me about this was like, oh, they're really giving you a much more direct insight into Rhaenyra's relationships and how they operate in private, whereas we aren't seeing a ton of that for Alicent. Yeah. And I think that that's intentional,
mm-hmm.
because this mm-hmm. episode really pushes Alicent into antagonist territory.
Mm-hmm. Mm, debatable, but.
Fair.
hashtag team Alicent. But no, I will say, I think it's clearly positioning the show and the show watchers to kind of sympathize with Rhaenyra. Like, it's showing you most things are mostly from her perspective. So I would agree with that notion. There's a scene when Aemon shows up on the beach, seemingly looking for Vhagar. This is the part of the episode that I thought was like, could have been better set up. Yes, we got a little bit of last week where Aemon is being tortured by the kids and he has this fascination with dragons and he like wants a dragon for himself. Like, we get all that. But there was like no setup for this scene where, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think there was a scene at the funeral wake where they're like, hey, did you see Vhagar? He's sitting over there on those hills over there. And Aemon's like, you know, like there's nothing where like they set up that like this might be a thing that he's doing.
We see him hear a dragon roar. There's like a shot of him kind of like looking up at the sky and the sun like moves behind the castle. And then you like hear a little dragon roar in the distance and he seems kind of curious by it.
Okay.
And then like wanders off. But you're right that they didn't really, for how serious this scene is about like the danger of dragon riding and the danger and like the what it takes to claim a dragon, we just kind of had to watch all that and pick up on it in real time. There wasn't like the like, oh man, now that Lena's dead, who's gonna possibly claim Vhagar? Or like,
I love the Kim Renfro impressions. But yes, there's nothing like that. There's no like who's gonna claim Vhagar. There's no here's how difficult it is to mount Vhagar. There's no Aemon being like, I should go check out Vhagar. It's a little odd. And as a result, I had no idea what the F is going on in the scene for a while until he like gets to the dragon and then like starts riding it. And I mean, Kim Renfro, how difficult is it for someone to typically claim a dragon in this way?
I would say very hard, especially one as large and full grown as Vhagar. Like you see that Aemon was on the verge of being.
Is it more difficult than trying to handle a cat while you're recording a podcast, which is what you're doing right now?
Yes, I'm actually very good at handling my cat while recording a podcast. My little beast. She claimed me. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is. It's very challenging, very risky. Literally, if you do not have Targaryen blood, it's all but a sure death sentence. We've seen in the Song of Ice and Fire books, there's a character, Quentin Martell, who doesn't exist in the show, who tried and failed spectacularly to ride one of Dany's dragons. So yeah, it's very hard. I think it shows he's got a lot of balls on this little kid. Like the way that he really stood his ground, he's using Valyrian phrases. The one that he says up front, Dohaeres, means serve. So like he's basically like staring this giant ancient dragon in the face and saying like, serve me. I'm a 10-year-old kid. But he pulls it off. Climbs up. I was like, how the hell the ropes.
Like, yeah, that was really cool. That's a cool touch, right?
Yeah, that she has like a whole like rope ladder, basically, like that she is just on her back at all times so that he can climb up there. Gave me a lot of vibes of How to Train Your Dragon. Have you seen those movies?
Mm-hmm.
I love those movies. And yeah, the whole like test flight. There's a really good test, like a scene where Hiccup, the character in How to Train Your Dragon, tries riding his dragon for the first time and it's very scary and dangerous, and then as soon as it starts working, like you sense that exhilaration. And I think the same thing happened in this episode, right, where like you see that Aemon is like about to lose his grip at any moment. It's very chaotic, but then like once they get in the zone, he's riding a gigantic destructive magical creature. And he did it all on his own. And so now Vhagar, dragons can only be bound to one rider at a time. And so it's like now nobody else is going to be able to ride Vhagar as long as Aemon maintains his claim over her.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like in reality, if this is a real thing, you'd want to have some kind of dragon security after. It's like if a nuclear weapon can only be bonded to one person, you'd want to have some kind of nuclear weapon security after like the person dies and anyone else can bond to it. You know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah, I think that, and again, maybe I'm just reaching, but I'm like, you can see that it was a very unexpected thing. Like it's not every day that somebody just decides that mm-hmm. they're going to risk their life to claim a dragon. And I don't think anybody expected it of Aemon. And I think he kind of knows that. That's why he comes back all like swaggy and confident afterwards, because you can see that he's like, oh yeah, I just did that. Like nobody here thought I would do that.
And I guess like the pool of people who might possibly do it is pretty limited, right? It's not like there's like a million people that are waiting to climb on the dragon. It's like there's maybe like 20 that might even be able to. So maybe they reallocate the security budget elsewhere for that.
Yeah.
One.
And there's an element of like disrespect to it, right? Like maybe they didn't think that they had to send anyone to guard Vhagar, because it wouldn't occur to the Valyrians that one of Alicent's kids would dare take Lena's dragon when they literally just finished burying her like a few hours ago, man. Didn't even wait.
Yeah. Yeah. So the kids start fighting because Aemon shows up and, Lena's children immediately realizes what's happened. Aemon has stolen one of the dragons that was theoretically could have been meant for one of them.
Mm-hmm.
A huge fight ensues, and Jace and Luce also show up. So Aemond, again, is Allison's child. Jason, he's the blonde one. Jason, Luce are the brown-haired ones. They are Rhaenyra's children. They show up. Basically, a massive fight ensues, and Aemon's eye is permanently damaged. It's or destroyed, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And we've seen scenes in movies and TV shows of kids fighting. You know, like, this is not an uncommon trope. But what I appreciate is that we get the Game of Thrones universe take on this. And in this universe, like, the kids are playing for keeps. Like, something terrible could happen at any time. And in fact, that's exactly what occurs. You then see the eye getting sewn up later. It looks horrible. Like, the whole, his face looks horrible and very damaged by it. And it's clear that, yeah, this is a tragedy that has occurred.
Mm-hmm.
And they kind of have this big fight in the hall where Allison says, I'm literally going to take an eye for an eye. And there's an escalating series of things that occur. But I actually really love this whole, between the beach fight and then the in the Great Hall and them arguing with each other, and how that felt, again, so tense and unpredictable and escalating, like anything could happen.
Mm-hmm.
We'll talk through some more details, but Kim, any thoughts on these sequences?
Yeah, I mean, whoever did the Foley work for that fight between the kids, like, the sound when Aemon's fist, like, connected with every single one of those kids, I was like, oh my god, he's punching them really hard. Like, they, this is not like a little slap fight between kids. Like, you felt the viciousness. And then as soon as Aemon escalated it to, like, hold, like, when he, like, has Luke by the throat and then picks up a rock, I was like, oh, he's out. Like, he could kill one of these boys right now. And both of those boys, as far as the realm is concerned, are, like, or at least for
are in the line of succession.
Jace,
right?
Jace is next in line. Like, it's bananas that he went as far as he did. And you felt that danger. And so then when you see, you know, the pocket sand knife to the face move, like, you kind of understand that they are truly defending themselves from their former peer and friend who, like, now might actually murder them. And so, like, it reminded me in season one of Game of Thrones when you see the fight between Arya and Joffrey, and, like, we, the audience, get to see what really happened and, like, the cruelty that was on display there from Joffrey. And then that moves into, like, trying to explain to the adults what happened, and it just becomes a big, like, he said, she said situation. With the similar chaos of, like, we can kind of get a sense for, like, what might be, like, the just response here. But as we see, Allison has no interest in believing that her son might have been at fault here. And Rhaenyra goes straight into, like, well, he called him a bastard, so, like, let's get this all out in the air one more time, I guess. So I thought it was really well done.
Yeah, there's a lot of, like, little things that I really enjoyed about this scene. Kind of, I loved Daemon just kind of sitting there in the back, cool as a cucumber, just chilling. Just, you know, he's not intervening. He knows that it's not his time to play his card. And the only time he does intervene is to stop Ser Criston from going after Rhaenyra, which is, you know, worth considering.
Yeah.
That's the only time when he felt it was worth stepping in.
Yeah. I also wasn't sure if Criston was headed for the kids. It's weird. He, like, goes around the group, and I was like, yeah, he probably is just trying to protect Allison. But then it's like, there's also a chance that he was making the split decision to enact his queen's order of bringing him Lucerys's eye. And so,
like,
yeah,
I think it was, you know, Allison's like, hey, Ser Criston, I order you to take that kid's eye. And I think Ser Criston was having a bit of a crisis of conscience, because he's supposed to protect the queen, but that doesn't necessarily extend to him taking out kids' eyes, right?
No,
like, that was kind of, yeah,
total overreach of his powers, or, like, of her power, of her
yes.
control in this situation, and he does not follow. I think smartly doesn't do exactly what she says, but it's like, you also see Viserys and Sir Harold, who's the captain of the Kingsguard. They both clock that as, like, oh, this relationship between Alicent and Criston is probably more inappropriate than we have realized, or, like, the loyalty here is crossing a line, right?
Yes. He's not just doing his duty anymore. He is,
Which, again, I have a wide understanding of Alicent and Kristen's behaviors, but like they seem to be getting more hypocritical the older that they get of, in mm-hmm. terms of like what they decide is honorable and decent is very easily moved around whenever they have a desire for action.
I will say that for all the challenges, and again, here, I just want people to understand, I'm like really making a conscious effort to kind of praise the things about the episode that I really like and decisions that they've made that have gone against other sentiments I've had about the show in the past. But this was the scene that fully justified Olivia Cooke being in the role of Alicent, where she's like, you know, I demand retribution. Like, I demand an eye. Like, the way she does that is so chilling, you know, and is so good that I'm like, oh, wow, she really nailed it. Like, in a way that I'm not saying who played Emily?
Emily Carey.
I'm not saying Emily Carey couldn't have done that. But I think that Olivia Cooke really brought something to it that was special. And so to me, this is the first scene in the last two episodes that I'm like, oh, wow, I totally get like why they wanted her to be in this role, because it's so good what she does with like you can tell how angry she is and like. And she's crossing a line and she does it so brazenly, you know, when she's like demanding the eye of this kid. Like, it's a moral line that it's like, you know, the relationship after this point is like irreparable. You have to imagine, right?
Yeah.
And so that's also like so many lines are being crossed in that scene. And I thought she just nailed that that performance. So anyway.
Yeah, you really believe that she believes what she's saying is the most righteous and like just path forward. But like you get to see on everybody's faces that like you're crossing a line. And not only is she crossing a line, but like Viserys is like doing a pretty piss poor job of reining her in. And I think that that's emblematic of what their relationship has been like. In the last episode, when she tells him like, you can do whatever you want when I'm dead. Like you, in this realm, the king's word is final on all matters. Like she has gotten herself into a place of power within her rule as queen that is overstepping, but Viserys seems to have not done a single thing to try and like curb that building impulse of hers, right? To call the shots.
Speaking of Viserys, he tries to get the truth out of Aemon, right? Where did you hear this horrible lie? And why did you, you know, theoretically, like Rhaenyra's kids were accused of being bastards and then that's why they struck him, and it was very insulting and terrible, right, for him to question their honor. So he's like, where did you hear this lie? And then I think you're meant to be like, is he going to name Alicent? Because that would be very bad for Alicent if he does. But instead he names Aemon. And he does that, I think. Well, why does he do that? Kim, you had a theory on and perspective on why he names Aemon instead of Alicent in that situation.
Aegon.
Oh, sorry, yeah. Aegon.
Why Aemon?
Aemon says Aegon is the one who lied about the print. I apologize. Yes.
No. Yeah. Yeah. I think to me that read as, because you played that clip earlier, and I was like, there's so much silence between the question and yes. the answer because you watch him. I felt like it seemed to me like you watch him know that it's his mother. Like to your point earlier, where like, apparently Alicent has been speaking to Aegon and Aemon about this enough to the point that they refer to Helaena as the future queen, right? Mm-hmm. Like, it's pretty obvious that it came from Alicent. But I think that they exchange this look where Aemon decides like, okay, if I actually say that right now, Viserys won't have any choice but to punish Alicent, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he clocks that and decides, okay, instead of throwing my mom under the bus, I'm going to throw
yes.
my drunk older brother under the bus.
A juvenile can get his record expunged when he's 18, you know? And so in Westeros as well. So yeah, it does seem to be a good way to diffuse the tension. And then of course Aegon's like, look, we all know what's going on, just look at them. And that's not something Alicent would have said, I don't think. So
true.
Another way of getting the poisonous toxic gossip out into the open as well. But I just loved when Aegon says, me, you know, it's like a whole it's like a very sitcom-y like, me? Like,
like he was so zoned out. Like, this has nothing to do. This has nothing to do with me. I just
he's
have
like
to stand
I don't even
here.
Know what's going on right now, man. Like, and it was hilarious. I thought.
Yeah.
So what else happens in this scene that's worth mentioning. Yeah, Allison says, like, he gets to decide which eye to keep. You know, the king is like, hey, look, let's just all put this behind us. And Allison's like, no, that's not good enough. So then she's like, I'm going to take one eye as well. He gets to decide which eye to keep. Kristen won't go over and take the kid's eye out. So then she grabs the dagger, which is a special dagger, right? It's the same dagger that killed the Night King. Wow, mm-hmm. This dagger certainly sees a lot of action throughout the course of Westeros history, huh?
Really does.
The cat's paw, right? Is what
yeah,
it is?
Yeah, it's referred to as the cat's paw blade because that is the dagger that Joffrey used, that Joffrey provided an assassin with to go try and kill Bran Stark in Game of Thrones.
I see.
And so
it was Joffrey that did that? I thought it was like a Lannister that did, or one of the Lannisters that did that.
Joffrey is a Lannister.
No, I know, but like, sorry, no. One of the older Lannisters, like no, Jaime or Cersei.
No, I think they don't really ever explain that super well, but in the books, Tyrion kind of puts two and two together that Joffrey probably overheard King Robert saying something about like, it would be a mercy just to kill the boy. And then Joffrey hired someone to try and like twistedly carry out King Robert's thoughts. Yeah.
Alrighty, one final thing before we get on with the show, which is a quick word from our sponsors. We'll be back soon with more discussion of season one, episode 7 of House of the Dragon. Allison lunges with a knife, and then Rhaenyra stops her, and there's this moment when like the knife blade is like right at her eye, and they kind of have this interaction, and then the knife eventually slashes open a huge portion of Rhaenyra's arm, and the scene basically ends at that point. I was a little bit annoyed that like at no point earlier in the scene did it come up that Aemon had claimed one of the dragons, like that was kind of the proximate cause of all this, but it seemed to be like a big reveal at the end, like, oh, that's what caused all this, you know? But
yeah,
whatever. Like, at no point while they're stitching up his eye did they say like, hey, he was out claiming dragons and then they got into fight, but whatever.
Yeah,
it's fine.
I really loved the dialogue here of Allison kind of like finally losing her shit in front of everybody. And when she says like, what have I done but what was expected of me, and then they cut to like the knife point with like fire in the background, like at Rhaenyra's eye, and I'm like, oh yeah, they're reminding us that like Rhaenyra also feels bound to this obligation of this prophecy that her father told her of, like, there has to be a Targaryen on the throne who has to carry out like this potential fight against the cold darkness coming for us all, whatever. So like, but Alicent doesn't know that side of why Rhaenyra is doing what she's doing. Alicent only sees herself. And when she says, like, I've forever been upholding the kingdom, the family, the law, while you flout your duty as you please. So, like, this is really Alicent's. Alicent is coming at this from a perspective of, like, I've done everything that was asked of me, regardless of how awful it was. And she thinks that she's being villainized for it, or like being cut out of the proper line of succession and things that should happen because Rhaenyra's children aren't legitimate. Whereas Rhaenyra has, sure, flouted certain like norms and customs, but never out of like a cruelty, in my opinion. It seems to mostly have been out of just a personal desire for equality, for what another heir to the throne would be able to do. And in this case, you know, she did try, according to her, with Laenor. They both acknowledged that, like, they tried behind the scenes to do their duty as expected. So,
I mean, okay, that's a pretty pro Rhaenyra reading of things, in my opinion. But
yeah, what's your counter?
It's not. I think that's mostly accurate. But like the idea of like, Rhaenyra is just doing her best. Just, you know, is like, okay. I mean, yes, they tried, but it felt like they didn't try very hard based on the dialogue. And also, like, Rhaenyra did, you know, have this long-standing relationship with Harwin that we never really see in the course of the show, but mm-hmm. like, you know, like that she like stepped out of bounds in a really big way over an extremely extended period of time, over mm-hmm. the course of many, many years. And so I just don't see Rhaenyra as kind of this beacon of virtue. I know I agree that in the Westeros universe, if a dude was doing this, like, it would be people might not bat an eye in the same way that they do with Rhaenyra, but the idea that like Rhaenyra is has a duty and she's doing everything she can, I just don't. that does not jive with what I'm seeing on screen of Rhaenyra personally, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I certainly would never describe Rhaenyra as a beacon of virtue.
Sure, sure.
Not
sure.
Even a little bit.
Fair enough. I apologize for the straw person argument then.
I think that you're right in that, and I'm sure that there are a lot of people that agree with you. The whole In Fire and Blood, Alicent and Rhaenyra are completely pitted against one another and like explained to be like having this like, I don't know, you know, hysterical women catfight type of thing. I think that the show is very intentionally letting us understand the different motivations that both Rhaenyra and Alicent have to be behaving the way that they're behaving. And it's all going terribly wrong. But we see Rhaenyra in private, like to Daemon, say like, I don't think Alicent is capable of cold-blooded murder. Like Rhaenyra still has some sort of sense of like regard for Alicent that is not reciprocated at all. Alicent only seems to want to talk about all of the terrible unjust things that Rhaenyra is doing, when I don't think that Rhaenyra actually has, you know, like the marriage proposal that Rhaenyra put forward last episode between Helaena and Jace, from Alicent's perspective, that's like, oh, you want to keep my daughter hostage and like, you know, completely tie our families to each other so that you can control all of them. I don't think that's what Rhaenyra actually had in mind. I think that she genuinely thought maybe we can salvage this. But they're just so beyond being able to communicate to one another their fears and their desires. And then this is the result, is that it's creating in-family strife. That's being passed to their children.
It's like when you have that friend of yours that has basically a toxic relationship with someone else where they literally no longer have the ability to interpret any of their actions positively. You know what I mean? Like that's kind of what Alicent is like with Rhaenyra. I will agree with you that I think that I think the show is making both of them out to be very sympathetic characters. I know people don't agree with them. They don't agree with that. Like people are much more pro Rhaenyra in overall, from what I can tell. But I think they're both tragic figures in their own way. And I don't see like Rhaenyra as that much more virtuous, if at all, than Alicent personally.
I think I'm not interested in seeing either of them be virtuous, right? I'm interested in seeing how they each attempt to wield power when they're being given very little avenues to do so, right? Mm-hmm. And they're both going about it in very different ways. Alicent is trying to stay within the laws and customs of the country because that's how things have been done for centuries. And she's like the old school Faith of the Seven type of person who has like that moral code and structure. And Rhaenyra is kind of like freeballing everything. Like she seems to be trying to kind of make it up as she goes with what she's being given. She didn't ask to be made heir to the Iron Throne. You know, she says at the beginning that she would be happy to ride around on her dragon with Alicent for the rest of her life and have freedom. I think that the show, just because of the changes that they're making to Fire and Blood, it feels like the show is going heavy pro Rhaenyra when it comes to kind of like explaining how things unfold. But that doesn't mean that Alicent is a straight up villain. Like there are many, many reasons to sympathize with what she went through as when she was younger and how that has all informed her survival instincts in the current timeline.
I agree with that. I do think you're right, though, that the show is kind of positioning Alicent to be the villain. Mm-hmm. There is a scene with Otto and Alicent where Alicent's like, "What? Okay, Dad, let's get it all out. Like, what do you have to say about it?" And he's like, good job. Good job back there." Like, he basically says, "Say what you will about the tenets of Alicent Hightower, but at least it's an ethos, Kim Renfro."
Sure.
You know, he's basically saying like at least, hey, I now know that you know what it takes to be on top, basically, right?
Yeah, and like to me that's a big admission. Like when he says we play an ugly game and now I see you have the determination to win it, he's acknowledging that what they're doing is strategizing and putting pieces on the table and not acting out of some, you know, divine moral code, but that their code dictates to them that this is what the right thing should be. And they will, it's like the ends justify the means argument, right? Where Otto seems content to let Alicent could like maybe wreak a little bit more havoc if in the end they get what they want, which is her children mm-hmm. on the Iron Throne, safe and on the Iron Throne.
He says, we play an ugly game, as you said, Kim. Hey, Kim, do you know what the game is?
It does it have to do with, I think you say Trones?
I think it might be a Game of Thrones.
Thrones?
That is the ugly game that they're playing. I don't know if you caught that. It's a little Easter egg for you guys, okay? The ugly game, the game he's referring to is the Game of Thrones.
You had to watch the episode three times to really pick up on that.
I mean, closer to five plus for me personally.
Yeah.
Rhaenyra and Laenor have an interaction that's actually quite nice. I should have been there. Those should be our house words. That was pretty hilarious. obviously, you get a sense of like the missed opportunities and connections that this family has had over the years. Mm-hmm. And I think Laenor, seeing the damage and the potential threats to the whole kingdom that occurred in the prior scene, or I guess he didn't even see them. He just saw the aftermath of them.
Yeah.
Right? Is like, okay, I gotta lean in to the family here, or else like things will go even more south. And so he says, I'm not going to go to war. I'm really going to invest in the family. I'm really going to be there for the kids. And he's basically trying to correct their old ways. He's recognizing that what they have is not working.
Yeah.
And he's trying to make it better, and he's trying to do an honorable thing. Right. So
yeah.
Nice.
It really broke my heart when he said like that he hates the gods for making him the way that he is, which I believe is an allusion to his sexuality and the fact that he has no interest in women, and therefore doing his duty in this family has been challenging for him. And the fact that Rhaenyra immediately is like, no, like you're a good, she like reassures him and gives him and like validates his experience and his life in a way that I really appreciated, especially watching it the first time, knowing what happens to him. Starting with this conversation, the whole rest of the episode was just like a roller coaster of emotions for mm-hmm. me, of like mm-hmm. of like we went from this really like sweet moment to then like when Rhaenyra is talking to Daemon and I was like, oh no.
Like, well, okay, so we should explain that in the books Laenor dies mysteriously and it's not clear exactly how he dies, is that right?
In the books, it's just said that Carl, like that him and Carl, who had been like acquaintances for some time, that they got into a fight in public and Carl stabbed Laenor to death. And it's kind mm-hmm. of like written off as like a, we're not really sure why that happened or like what escalated to what. It's just known that like he was killed tragically. Right. And then
you're like, and you're watching this, you're like, oh my gosh, they're going to make Rhaenyra the one responsible for it. And then a flip again at the end where it's like, oh my gosh, she's actually not responsible for it. Or she is, but he's not dead, you know?
Yeah.
So.
Like I thought, because, you know, you've already identified it. I'm pretty pro Rhaenyra throughout most of this show so far. I've really kind of been in lockstep with understanding, even when she does things that are detrimental to others or whatever, I've been sort of like, I get why she's doing this, and I don't really fault her for it necessarily. This was the first time where I was like, oh no, they're turning me on Rhaenyra. I was like, I can't justify this. Like, Laenor has truly done nothing wrong. He just had that really sweet conversation with her where he recommitted to their marriage, and like I was kind of like, of course Daemon and Rhaenyra are gonna conspire together to murder this innocent man so that they can marry. Like, yeah, sure, that tracks. But I was like, I was grieving my loss of my pro Rhaenyra stance as this scene went on. And then boom, surprise, he's alive and it's fine. And I can continue being pro Rhaenyra because in fact, this is a very wonderful character development for her of like ensuring a like safe, protected passage for him to go like live his life where he maybe doesn't have to sit around and just feel ashamed of who he is constantly. Like mm-hmm. I thought that was a really great thing. And I really enjoyed the little switcheroo game that the writers played with book readers in this example. Yeah. 'Cause it's hard to surprise us. But we were surprised, and it's very fun when that happens.
As a show watcher only, I was not really surprised, you know, because they give you like all these hints about what's going to happen. I mean, it's a really cool montage when she says, when Daemon says, you know, we can't marry unless Laenor is dead. And she's like, I know. And then you see Daemon killing some random guy. So it's like, okay, what's going on there?
Yeah.
Then you see the Laenor and Carl fight. And then a body emerge from the ashes who you cannot identify. And it's like, oh, that's clearly not Laenor. Like, right from that point, it's like, that's not Laenor. Because that's kind of how TV shows and films do this kind of reveal. So still very well done when he gets on the boat at the end. It's like a cool reveal. He takes off the hood. You see it's him. They're on the, it's a beautiful shot of them on the boat together. But I just thought it was like a pretty well executed scene. I wasn't as head faked multiple times as you were. So it's kind of cool. It's kind of cool, Kim, that like this is like an inverse. Like usually it's the show watchers being shocked. And for once, it's like the book readers that were really taken aback. So that's a nice reverse of the dynamic there.
Yeah.
So.
And in a positive way, right? Because like in last episode, it was a little bit of a reveal to book readers that Laris Strong was the one who orchestrated the fire and killed them. But it's like, that's a tragic reveal. That's a like, oh God, this person's worse than I thought reveal. Whereas this was like, oh, this person's better than I thought reveal of like Rhaenyra and Daemon didn't go for the straight murder that they clearly probably could have pulled off given that like-
I mean, it's also a character that we've gotten to know over like six episodes as opposed to some guy who showed up for 5-10 minutes one time, you know, like
true.
I think that was my whole point with the Laris thing last episode was like the turn doesn't mean that much if you don't even know who the character was or was supposed to be prior to that.
Right. But us thinking that Rhaenyra, who we've seen grow up, who we've seen, you know,
this could have been when she broke bad. This could have been like that's exactly.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it is very telling that the writers chose to have it go that way. Again, just kind of making it more clear that the show's bird's eye view of what happened during this period of Targaryen history is much more empathetic towards Rhaenyra than the accounts that we got in Fire and Blood.
The only other things to mention about what happened this episode, there's a Laris Alicent scene where, to quote another... Was I quoting Coen Brothers movie earlier? To quote The Big Lebowski, or to refer to The Big Lebowski, lots of Walter Sobchak energy coming out of Sir Laris in the scene. He's like, are you sure? You know, Walter Sobchak in The Big Lebowski is like, I could get you a toe by 2 o'clock with nail polish on it. You know, like, and Laris is like, are you sure you don't want you don't want me to get that eye for you? I could totally get that eye for you, like easily. It's not even, it would be no skin off my back. It's just a piece of cake. And she's like, no, that's quite all right. I'm good. No eye necessary.
Yeah. She's learned that she has to be very clear.
Yes, exactly.
No innuendos here about what I wish might happen. Yeah. Please back off.
We see Rhaenyra and Daemon marry, basically, right? They get married and it's a small ceremony, you know? It's unclear to me how much time has passed in the last like 5 minutes of this episode, you know, because... They have to kill Laenor. They have to like engineer that whole stunt.
Right. So that's like an evening overnight.
At least, you know, Kim. I mean,
right.
He has that conversation with Carl, like, and then so then they need to like bury Laenor and then they get married. You know, so I feel like they're like really fast forwarding past a bunch of developments. There's probably like a week goes by or so. At least a week goes by in the last few minutes of the episode.
Yeah.
But I don't know if you had any thoughts on the wedding. We've seen a couple weddings in Game of Thrones universe. This is one that seems to be A, consensual, and B, not have a actual tragedy associated with it, only a theorized tragedy.
Yeah.
So that's a plus positive points right there.
Yeah. More blood than I'm used to in mouths. For weddings.
It was a new thing.
Yeah. The thing that popped in my
head is
that
it's like a Targaryen touch maybe, or
I'm guessing that this is what a traditional Targaryen or High Valyrian wedding ceremony looks like, seems like. I thought it was like, I was like, okay, great, here we go. Daemon and Rhaenyra are finally together. Their kids look a little like nonplussed by the situation. I'm wondering how exactly they explained that to the children.
Right.
We'll see.
Or maybe not, depending on how quickly these time jumps keep happening. But yes,
true. I thought it was like somewhat romantic. I love Emma Darcy. I think that they have such a physical, Like their fit, their
they
physical
have a good chemistry. Good chemistry.
Yeah, like good hand touching with Matt Smith. Like they're good. They have very good believable, like tactile. Mm-hmm. I feel a closeness to you, and so watching mm-hmm. them in that wedding ceremony, like literally sharing the blood off of their mouths with one another and stuff.
They slice their hands open and like hold yeah. hands and stuff like that too. Yeah.
Yeah. Which I'm again, you know, everybody harps on about the fact that like Targaryen blood is very important for aligning people. But it also reminded me of like how Dany, like the Dothraki customs that Daenerys absorbs in Game of Thrones. And, you know, she refers to her most trusted advisors and like protectors as blood of my blood. And I was like, obviously this isn't a Dothraki reference in this wedding, but I was like, yeah, they're going pretty heavy on the symbolism of like, we are literally like uniting our blood, and that bond is going to be stronger than any other type of political alliance that might happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that is basically the episode of House of the Dragon. I did have one other thing I wanted to bring up, mm-hmm. and it was, I don't even know if I can remember the point, but it was basically something that was brought up in our weekly Twitter space on Sunday nights. Kim Renfro and I do a weekly Twitter space. Be sure to follow us both on Twitter. She's at Kim R. Renfro. I'm at Dave Chensky. And every Sunday night we like react to the episode as it happens. People kind of tweet at us and we respond to them with our thoughts on the episode. One of the points that was brought up in the space this week was that that Laenor is being very cruel to his parents because they've just lost their daughter, Laena. Mm. They're now losing their only other child, and he's kind of inflicting that on them. And that is very unfortunate. And
yeah.
I can't imagine they would be really upset by that, because at this point they have no relatives, like no descendants by blood at this point. Is that right? Or...
They have their granddaughters.
Oh, yeah. Damon's children. That's right. That's right.
So, right. Okay. So like they have their granddaughters, but they established in that scene that we talked about between Rhaenys and Corlys that like Rhaenys feels very distraught by the fact that Damon basically has control over the last of their blood.
Yeah.
So even that is probably a very
tenuous.
Minimal comfort. And it is kind of like, yeah, it's awful that they're mourning his death, especially like such a kind of like horrible, tragic, cold-blooded murder the way that they staged it. But I'm also like, I don't believe that Laenor would his position as king consort seemed very untenable given the rumors that are swirling around, given mm-hmm. the fact that he is a closeted gay man. Like I think that he was going to be in danger either way, and it's like he made the choice to just get it over with as opposed to dragging out what I'm sure would be, I don't know, worse implications of him trying to like, trying to continue the facade of being Rhaenyra's husband.
Indeed. All right. Well, those are our thoughts on season 1, episode 7 of House of the Dragon, Driftmark. And again, you can always find more episodes of this podcast at acastofkings.com, YouTube, TikTok, Twitter, at acastofkings. Email us at acastofkings@gmail.com as well. Kim, any other thoughts as we close out this week?
Go be nice to each other. People of the world. That's
yeah,
all.
my friend Jeff, who I played the clip from earlier, his bafflement at the events of last episode. He has a thing he likes to say at the end of his podcast, you know, think about what you put out into the world and try to make it a better place. So I always appreciate that. Anyway, thanks for listening to Acasta Kings. We'll be back next week with another episode. Until then, see you later.